Coming up, jump shot, layup, alley-oop, the shot clock.
Philosophy and basketball.
The idea of sport, of playing games, of learning how to work together, of playing by the rules.
Sports and ritual. Sports as ritual.
There's an expression, no cheering in the press box. But I have always felt that if you're covering a game and you don't care for one side or the other, then you're not going to write a very good story.
Our guest is Frank DeFord, one of America's premier sports writers.
The best sports to write about are those with the fewest clothes and the fewest competitors. It's not always the aesthetic that rules, even when you're talking about art.
Is basketball more beautiful than other team sports?
The philosophy of hoops.
Coming up, Philosophy Talk, after the news. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of 91.7 KALW, local, innovative public radio for San Francisco.
We're continuing conversations that began at Philosopher's Corner, or in today's case, at Maples Pavilion on the Stanford campus.
Maples Pavilion, that oasis of thought, huh? Yeah.
Absolutely.
We migrate from there to the air via the signals of this radio station and our ever-growing number of affiliates, and from the air to the internet via our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org. Go check it out. So, the philosophy of basketball, John. How'd you get me into this? What's philosophical here?
Well, think about it, Ken. Art has always been a topic of philosophical interest. Art of all sorts. Drama, painting, sculpture, poetry. Aesthetics, it's called. I'll tell you more about it someday.
Yeah, I get you. So you think of basketball and other sports as instances of beauty, of aesthetically pleasing objects.
Well, maybe they are, maybe they aren't, but people claim that. Sports writers claim that. Fans claim that. So philosophers can think about it.
But, you know, in one way, I think... You know, art is morally significant, people think. Great drama, great the rise and fall of human lives and human relationships and empires can be the subject of art. And basketball is about bouncing a little ball around and throwing it in a hoop. And moreover, art is pretend, drama is pretend, basketball is real. I mean, you really do have to overcome obstacles and all that sort of stuff. I mean, I think basketball is cool, but it's a lot different from art.
Well, a lot of people think that pretense is at the heart of art, or at least particularly of things like drama and novels. And there's no doubt about it, when you're playing a basketball game or even a badminton game, it's not pretend. You're there to win. But I think pretense has a role in both cases. In the case of art, typically the events you're depicting would, if they were to occur, be of great significance. The death of a person, the death of an empire, love, things like that. But they're not real. You're pretending them. In the case of something like basketball, the events themselves are quite real. It really is a game. There will be a winner and loser. But you kind of have to pretend that it all matters.
Right.
It is just dribbling down and putting a ball in a hoop when push comes to shove. But to get our emotions involved, we have these elaborate institutional forms of pretense that involve the whole culture.
You're opening my eyes here. I think there's something deep here. In art, often we have pretend worlds. Worlds of great significance, but they're pretend worlds. In basketball, we have like micro worlds, right? Of no real significance, but we pretend they're of significance. So there's pretense in both places. But there's also this analogy. Basketball is competitive, highly competitive. You know, in a symphony, all the players and the participants, everybody wants to see the most beautiful performance possible. They have a shared interest. But would you rather see your team win a really ugly game or lose in a really beautiful game?
Well, you're making another interesting point. There seems to be a disanalogy. You say that, well, maybe there is an aesthetics to basketball, but it ain't what matters. What matters is the home team winning. But I must say, when I taught at UCLA in the 1960s, we didn't have to make that choice because our basketball teams were the most beautiful and the most winning of any college teams in the country.
You know, our roving philosophical reporter, Polly Stryker, admits she knows nothing at all about basketball, but she found somebody who knows a great deal about it, as much as anybody. She files this report.
If you want to find out about the philosophy of basketball, who better to ask than Coach John Wooden, legendary head coach emeritus of men's basketball at UCLA. Even people who don't follow sports have heard of John Wooden. I spoke with Coach Wooden by phone at his home. He's 95 years old and got his philosophy of success from his father, who told him,
"Never cease trying to be the best that you could be at whatever you're doing. That may not be as good as someone else. And you're the only one that would really know whether or not you have made the effort to execute into your own particular level of competency. And if you do that, you never lose." So in teaching sports and basketball, let the score be a byproduct of the preparation that you make in order that you might execute near your own ability level.
Amazingly, he never used the word win with his players.
I tried never to use the word winning. I might by inference here and there on occasions, but I tried not to. I just want the main concern to be the preparation, and failure to prepare is preparing to fail. And you can be outscored and still feel that you are successful. And you can outscore someone and feel that you're unsuccessful. I want them to definitely feel that way. And I know that as time went by, I learned to accept those things myself.
This view of success helped Wooden in 1959-1960, which was perhaps the team's worst season.
That group came as close to realizing their full potential as some teams I might have had that went undefeated. I think they came close to their own ability. They worked toward it, and they never gave up because they were having trouble outscoring opponents. And I was just as proud of them. I would tell you honestly that the media didn't look at it that way, nor did the alumni, but I did.
Teamwork was so important to Coach Wooden that he would bench an excellent player to preserve overall harmony.
Well, there was one season. I will not mention this individual's name, but he had as much physical ability to play the position that I wanted a player to have as you could possibly have, and yet he didn't work in well with the team. His statistics would be very good, but as his statistics became higher, his teammates all went down lower. So this person sat on the bench a good part of the year, just played off and on until he learned what team play was all about. And he would say to me on occasion, "Coach, you know I'm better than different players." He'd be, and I'd say, "Yes, I know that. And it's just too bad that you're letting them beat you out. But until you learn that it is a team game, that's exactly what's going to happen."
So what's the most important lesson people can take from basketball?
Consideration for others. If we had more consideration of others, the heads of state throughout the troubled world, we wouldn't have as many problems. And certainly you can learn that in team sports, that the consideration for others can bring dividends.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Polly Stryker.
Thanks, Polly, and thanks to basketball coaching legend John Wooden, who gave us so many great years at UCLA. His latest book is Wooden on Leadership. I'm John Perry, and with me is Ken Taylor.
And we're joined by Frank DeFord, senior writer at Sports Illustrated, commentator on NPR's Morning Edition, author of many books, I think 14 at last count, and is with his latest being The Old Ball Game. Frank, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you, gentlemen. Nice to be with you.
Frank, basketball is clearly and indisputably a lot of things. But there is this claim that it's this great aesthetic thing, that it's more beautiful than, I don't know, football, baseball, or even curling.
Oh, yeah.
is this just mumbo-jumbo, or is basketball really an aesthetic object that has something special?
I think basketball is probably prettier than most games. The NBA has tried to sell it that way, and I think wisely. I think there are elements of other games. For instance, the double play in baseball. The shortstop and the second baseman pivoting there as a runner slides in. I don't know if there's anything as pretty as that, say, on the ballet stage. But overall, I think basketball is probably as pretty a team game as there is. I think they're certainly individual sports. Diving, for example, figure skating, would in essence be more aesthetically pleasing, but basketball as a team game would be at the top of the tree, I think.
Don't you think? I mean, I'm not a great, huge follower of basketball, especially the NBA. I actually get more excited by college basketball, especially this time of year. But as a team game, hasn't professional basketball started to lose out a little bit? I mean, college basketball is very much team-oriented. You have the guy there who's only a playmaker and not a shooter, and that doesn't happen all that much in the NBA, does it?
Oh, I think you're absolutely right, and I think there's a general consideration about that the NBA has become much too much one-on-one. In other words, it's not a team game anymore. It's one fella taking the ball and the other four guys getting out of the way, and so that it becomes some sort of a distortion of a team sport. And a lot of people fear that basketball is generally headed in that direction because, at least in the United States, individual play is emphasized from an early age. The Europeans and the South Americans do a much better job of working on team concepts, which is one of the reasons that we haven't done so well in international play recently and why so many international players have made it in the NBA.
Well, a lot of people would say that, well, there was a watershed here. I'm fading on his name, scored over 100 points in one game.
Will Chamberlain.
Will Chamberlain, of course. I mean, he was pretty much a team player at Kansas, but 100 points in a game, that's never been done since. Wasn't that kind of the high point of selfish sports?
But you see, Wilt all along was trumped by Bill Russell and the Boston Celtics, Russell being unanimously almost accorded the honor of being the greatest team player in any sport, not just in basketball, because Russell had that marvelous ability to make everybody around him better, to make the unit better. And so that even when Chamberlain was scoring all those points, he was losing to Russell. And so team was the best then, even with the greatest individual player around, and I think that was very important to basketball.
Okay, but let's think about this though. I mean, this goes back to the point that John and I were discussing up in the early part of the show. I said one of the things about sports that makes it different from art is that in art, the aesthetic value of the thing is intrinsic to it. In basketball, wouldn't I rather have my team win ugly? You know, win in an ugly game than lose in a beautiful.
Yeah.
Of course. And so the aesthetic thing is, and so whatever it takes to win, forget about the beauty of the sport. I mean, what do you think about that? So sports can't really be concerned with the beauty of the thing.
It can't primarily be concerned about the beauty of the thing, but I would also suggest, I would ask an artist, would you like to paint a painting which you think is really beautiful, which sells for $1,000, would you like to paint one that's really not very pretty, but which is commercial and sells for $1 million? So those kinds of contradictions are apparent everywhere. Most people would say that opera is the supreme form of voice, but opera is struggling to make it these days. Many more people prefer rap, which would be at the other extreme. Well, so it's not always the aesthetic that rules, even when you're talking about art.
And, you know, if I had a choice between a really beautiful, well-balanced, superbly done painting of some place I'd never been and maybe a somewhat mediocre plus painting of a place that meant a lot to me, I'd take the second. Now,
well, that's true. But when you that artist you asked, Frank, about that unfortunate trade-off, she would feel that she was betraying an artistic ideal to which she was dedicated, right? I mean, are players and managers and owners, are they at all dedicated to the ideal of the game as a theater of human perfection, of the exercise of high skill, or is it all just secondary to, you know, commercial interests?
I remember a game just played the other day. It was, I think it was UCLA in Memphis. It was a dreadful game. I think it finished 50-45. And everybody said, what an awful game. And the players themselves acknowledged that it was a terrible game. And even the winners, well, they didn't give the victory back, but they felt somewhat chagrined that they had played so terribly. So I don't think it's unusual for people to say – Well, we won, but we certainly didn't do a good job of it. I don't think that's you know, absent altogether.
You're listening
from sport.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Our subject today is the philosophy of hoops. That would be basketball for you non-hipsters out there. Our guest is the senior writer at Sports Illustrated, Frank DeFord.
We've been talking about what people like about sports, basketball in particular, both as spectators and participants. Next, we'll move on to what people gain from participating in sports, their educational value, if any. You can join us by calling 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134.
Hoops, hollers, and your emails and calls when Philosophy Talk continues.
Brother Bones and Sweet Georgia Brown, the theme for the Harlem Globetrotters, as if anyone in the world didn't know that. This is Philosophy Talk, and I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Today we're discussing basketball with Frank DeFord. Are you a basketball fanatic? Do you think it's better than any other sport? Have you gotten lots out of participating in basketball or other sports? Tell us your thoughts.
The number is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. 4134. You can also email us at comments@philosophytalk.org. You can go to our website and push the comments button to send an email too.
So, Frank, look, let's grant basketball players get a lot out of playing basketball, especially at the higher levels of the NBA, say. They get financially remunerated. They get a lot of physical exercise. They develop a high degree of skill. But I'm an educator, and I'm interested in moral education of our youth. Can basketball play any positive role in moral education at all?
Oh, sure. I mean, I think all sports can. And I don't think it's fair to separate one sport out from all the others. I think the idea of sport, of playing games, of learning how to work together, of playing by the rules, of giving yourself up, sacrificing yourself up for the team, I think all of those are qualities that can enhance a young person's growing up.
Well, I agree with you to a certain extent. It's certainly true that kind of intrinsic to the sport. I mean, the sports are kind of like a little moral theater in which you work out all these different things. You learn tenacity, teamwork, you know, fair play, all that stuff. But, you know, being a university professor and watching the way the NBA has gone, you mix in with all that stuff that's intrinsic to the sport, money and fame, and it seems to me that it all goes to whack. And that as a theater of morality, moral education, it's deeply problematic.
Now, you're talking about two different things. You started talking about little kids playing and how it could help them, and suddenly we leapt to the top, to the main professionals. Now, where are we going to talk, or do we want to talk about it all?
I want to talk about it all. Start with which one that you start with the little kids and how it can be a theater of moral education for little kids.
No, and I just did that. I said it's a question of learning to work together. And by the way, I think it was either Plato or Aristotle, since we're talking about philosophy, who was a very good wrestler. I forget which one.
Yeah.
but
so was I. And so was
I just
want to.
No,
so was I, and so was John Perry, by the way.
Well, I just want to say that you know, we've got good antecedents here. But as far as at the top, isn't it also true that singers and artists at that level are making great deals of money? It can be twisted in their ethics. And, well, in other words, what I'm saying is, what difference is an athlete at that level from a businessman, from a singer, from an actor, from anyone, a writer, from anyone in any profession? What's the difference?
To go closer to home, who could doubt that philosophy is educationally valuable for a kid in high school or college?
But well, lots of colleges.
We all know philosophy professors. We don't know philosophy professors that are corrupted by earning millions of dollars a year, but the little perks they have often go to the head and they turn into complete SOBs.
Well, but wait a minute, though. Let's go back to the kids a little bit. One of the things that deeply saddens me about a certain local sports hero on a certain local baseball team who, with a certain steroid controversy, is that he's hero to many, many kids I know. I coach Little League baseball, and many, many of my players, they put me in left field. That's where a certain person plays, right? But this whole steroids thing, I mean, it corrupts the whole thing, and it filters down to high school sports and all this stuff. And I don't know. So I think the perks that these guys entitled to themselves and the liberties they take don't just affect them. It affects youth sports as well.
I just finished a novel called The Entitled, which is very much about all of that. We could talk about that next year when it comes out.
Well, talk about it a little bit now. Just give us a foretaste of your
thoughts. No, because the title itself says it, that so many athletes do feel entitled. They feel, and not only athletes at the top level like Barry Bonds, but kids younger and younger, and it's particularly true of basketball players. They're corrupted at my gracious, now in junior high. People cheat for them. They take them out of school and lie for them and put them in another school district. They're not required to go to school. People write term papers for them and so forth and so on. And they're given money under the table at very young ages. And so the corruption of athletes is not only at the top level, but it goes all the way through our society. But I would suggest that you are thinking that kids are a lot dumber than they really are. I don't think that children are so naive as to think that all athletes are good guys with pristine personalities. I think children understand that any group of adults, any professional group of adults, that some of them are going to be really sweet guys, some of them are going to be jerks, some of them are going to be smart, some of them are going to be dumb, some of them are going to be thugs. But I don't think that that necessarily turns them off from the sport or from the goodness of life when one bad apple shows up in any one profession.
I
think children are smarter than that.
I certainly hope you're right. We don't question anybody's intelligence, including children's. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing the philosophy of basketball with noted sports writer Frank DeForn. We'd love to have you join us. 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And Umberto in Oakland's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Umberto.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call. I wanted to address the question of aesthetics versus weight. I happen to be a person who enjoys sports in general, almost essentially for its aesthetic value. I really don't care who wins or loses. I'm interested in a beautiful, engaging, dramatic match, whether it's in baseball, basketball, etc. As for your question, what do I get out of it? Well, I get the experience of awe and wonder from watching such a match. Where the match is of low aesthetic quality, then it tends to be, for me, boring and unengaging. So I just wanted to throw those 2 cents in there. I really don't care at this point who wins or loses. It hasn't always been the case. At one point, I was very committed to who won or lost. I had my favorite teams in the whole affair. But at this point, it really doesn't matter.
Do you love it more now that you don't have a team and you're invested in a team? I always find that somehow if I invest in one side winning or losing, then it grips me more, even if it's a beautiful contest. Do you have any experience like that, Umberto?
Sure. So, indeed, you're right. I no longer have strong preferences in terms of teams. I don't have a stake in any team. I don't have a favorite. So it's also true that I tend to watch far less than when I was, say, a teenager and then into my early 20s. I don't even keep up with the sports page anymore, where one time I would read 2 and 3 sports pages a day to keep up with stats and histories and drama of the players' lives. So I certainly have withdrawn. So whenever I do get out, my concern is really for the aesthetics of the game.
Thanks a lot. Frank, I have a question. As a sports writer, I assume it must be part of your professional ethic not to root for a team, but just to be a dispassionate observer and reporter. Is that right? I mean, and does that take away from the enjoyment of the game?
There's an expression, no cheering in the press box. But I have always felt that if you're covering a game and you don't care for one side or the other, then you're not going to write a very good story. I mean, that means you're not engaged. I think it's human nature. Even if you start a game off and don't care, at some point you're going to pick a favorite. I think it would be a strange person who could avoid that. It's even said that referees, the most scrupulous referees of all, cannot stop themselves in a lopsided game from occasionally helping the loser because they want to see a good game, you see. They want to see it get closer. And I'm talking absolutely subconsciously, but that is suggested. So, yeah, I think you have to root for someone if you're really going to enjoy it. It's about competition, and it's about a lot of other things as well. And Coach Wooden made a good point. But I just think, you know, at the end of the day, you're more satisfied to win than you are to play to the best of your abilities and lose. I think.
I think that goes back to John's point. There's an element of pretense. You have to pretend that it matters. Right? There's mm-hmm. real stuff happening, but you have to invest it with pretend mattering. Right?
Well, you know, I, as a fan, I don't have any great loyalties now. Frankly, the baseball strike just kind of wiped out most of my real intense loyalties. But even when I'd had a lot of loyalties, my team's mostly lost. So that by the time of the World Series or March Madness, I didn't have any favorites in there. And in that mood, you often do care about the aesthetics of the game. And it's like you said about the referee. You want the game to be tight. You want, you know, for a while you mm-hmm. cheer for the team that's behind. And then maybe if they get ahead, you cheer for the other team. So I think you can be involved in this kind of way that isn't kind of a permanent loyalty to one team. It is involved in liking the aesthetics of the game, but the aesthetics of sports do involve competition and excitement and tension until the end.
We've got a whole lineup of callers. Taylor in Oakland's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Taylor. With a name like that, you've got to have a good comment.
Yeah, well, my theory is this: as far as sports, all it is entertainment at this stage. There's different levels of entertainment. And so whether someone get a breast implant so they can look better on a movie screen, so they can get an edge and get their name out there and be one of the best beautiful actresses, or whether a baseball player takes vitamins and work harder at night, all it is giving yourself an edge. And it means it has nothing to do with, I think, performance. It has something to do with entertainment. And athletes are nothing but entertainers at this stage.
What do you think about that, Frank? Thanks for the call, Taylor.
Oh, I don't think there's any question that sport is just another form of entertainment. But it also works the other way around, that all the things that we've been talking about and keeping them up on a very highfalutin level, art and music and literature and so forth, invariably they end up with competitions as well, the Academy Awards being the most famous.
Good point.
There are competitions for the best books. There are competitions for the best actors on Broadway, on television. There's music competitions and so forth and so on. So obviously, sport sort of spills over into every element of our lives. I think you even find today, unfortunately, that so much that's written about politics is written in a sports contest. Not what a candidate might be saying, but who's ahead in the race.
Right.
That seems to matter more than anything else. So sports, in a way, for better or for worse, has infected, I think, a lot of our lives because it is such good entertainment.
Well, it has infected our lives. I remember a hot department meeting a few years ago where one of the members said, would we quit referring to a potential appointment as a slam dunk? They thought that kind of demeaned the whole process. I've got an interesting email here talking about whether sports is real or pretend. This fellow, whose name is Defstick, his username at any rate, the Mayans.
What is his name? Dipstick?
No, not quite. Defstick.
Defstick.
Yeah. An interesting comment. The Mayans had a game of Pocatoc, much like basketball. Priests coach teams, and losing teams could be executed. Does a social or religious consequence of basketball so repugnant detract from basketball's beauty? Well, I mean, they had managed to make the sports continuous with life and death.
Oh, it's sumo wrestling, too.
Maybe that's a good idea.
Sumo wrestling, too, and its generation had kind of ritual significance and all that. Frank, what do you think about all that kind of stuff?
I remember seeing that court down in Chichen Itza in Mexico, and I think they threw the losers off the same cliff that the virgins were chucked over to appease the gods. Well, they played tougher in those days.
Yeah, there you go.
You know, that's all I can say. Life was cheaper. And there were a lot of games. I mean, lacrosse, I think, for example, that the Indians played, particularly in Canada, was a game that ended up with a lot of fatalities. And I suppose that's been true
I suppose
years. Luckily, we don't do that now, except by accident. There was a terrible accident a couple of days ago in Florida, and an automobile race driver was killed. But that was not the intent to kill. I think boxing is the only sport that you would have a hard time justifying from an ethical basis, because the idea is to hurt your opponent. Now, boxing people try to to mask that. They've called it the sweet science, which is perfectly the classic euphemism. Mm-hmm. And they said, well, you're not really trying to hurt someone. You're trying to outpoint them and so on and so forth. But boxing, I think, is the last of our sports where the idea is to win by placing personal harm on someone else.
If I was an owner and I'd put together one of these teams of really high-priced people like Madrid Real these days, and then they lost, then the idea of putting them all to death and starting over with a zero budget might not seem so bad.
Oh, John. Therese in Brisbane's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Therese.
Hi.
What's your comment or question?
Well, my comment is, first of all, I want to tell Mr. DeFord how witty a fellow I think he is. I just never want to miss his commentary on Wednesday mornings.
Thank you.
My point, though, is that I appreciate a sport in direct ratio to how much clothing the athletes wear. So I've never in my whole life, and I'm really proud of this fact, ever watched a football game from beginning to end. I've seen snatches of it here and there, but I adore tennis. I love basketball, and I wish Mr. DeFord hadn't brought up boxing as a sport because that sort of ruins my theory. But that, I want to see the athletes' faces.
You want to see beautiful bodies, too, it sounds like.
Well, yeah, but I want to see the expression on their faces. When they have the helmet on and you can't even see their lips or their eyes or anything else, it's just so distracting for, you know, what are they feeling? What's the emotion here?
Yeah, and the emotion in sports, Frank, is real. It's not pretend emotion like on the stage.
Right? No, but what she said is absolutely right. I'll take it one step further. The best sports to write about are those with the fewest clothes and the fewest competitors. Football, for example, may be our most popular sport, but as the caller suggested, you can't see the faces. They're hidden under all that protective armor. Tennis is a magnificent sport to write about, and that's why they keep making so many stupid boxing movies, even though boxing is a fringe sport now. I mean, Sylvester Stallone is coming back to the screen as Rocky at the age of 60. Do we need this?
Wow.
No.
But they're going to call that Rocky Chair or something like that.
But it's because it's so basic and primeval even. So from a dramatic point of view, boxing's the best sport from
well,
a
Frank,
dramatic
it,
point of view.
Sounds like we can expect you to have more and more columns on women's beach volleyball, because I think that's the minimal outfits I've seen.
I simply watch that as a fan.
Pablo in San
Francisco. The aesthetics of it.
Pablo in San Francisco is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Pablo.
I loved your previous caller's comment about the being able to see the expressions of the players. But now your guest mentioned something about human nature, and my comment is that I'm actually involved in them, but I think that the competition is the most corruptive fact of sport, and that I mean, in terms of either ethical or moral perspective. And you know, I would posit that at one time we had somewhat of a consciousness of sport. Of a quote-unquote pure nature, and I don't want to get into master race theories here, but you know, what's your guest comment on? Is there any way to get rid of competition and still have people have a drive to do their best?
Thanks for the call, Pablo. What do you think, Frank?
No, I don't think so. And as a matter of fact, it disturbs me when I read things like, we're not going to list class rankings anymore because it may upset the students. I think that all of us have to test ourselves in all of our ways. And in some things, God knows I have been found wanting in so many things in my life. But to conceal that from me by taking the element of challenge and competition out of it, I think at the end of the day is very self-defeating. And I think competition is good. Oh, sure, it goes over the line, as it does so often, and then it turns on itself, but I think that competition is part of the human element, the human condition.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing the philosophy of hoops, that is basketball, with Frank DeFord from Sports Illustrated.
We've been talking about the educational aspects of basketball and other sports. We're going to move on to the effect of basketball and other sports on our culture. The number is 415-841-4134.
Basketball and the degradation of our culture. And your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
Cheech and Chong and Basketball Jones. Philosophy Talk brings music and sports together, two elements of high culture. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. We're discussing the philosophy of basketball with Frank DeFord, senior writer at Sports Illustrated. So, is basketball, big time professional basketball, college basketball, are they good for society? Is it good that some of our colleges and universities are better known for their athletic programs and their educational program? Is the hero worship of basketball players and other sports figures a good thing or a bad thing for American youth?
Join us by calling 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You can also email us, comments@philosophytalk.org.
So, look, Frank, I want to ask, the last caller before the break was talking about, he seemed to think that competition was intrinsically corrupting. I don't believe that at all, right? I think competition is an inelimitable and important aspect of human life. But competition joined with big-time money, big-time media, people taking shortcuts, and hero worship of these people taking shortcuts to get the big-time payoff. And then in some ways debasing the game itself. That, I think, is corrupting and has a terribly corrupting influence on our culture. What do you think?
I can't agree with you more. I think you've made an absolute case for it, that when it's bad, it's real bad, and it's indefensible.
But you know, it's not sports that brought competition to our culture. Our culture is in many ways based on competition. Our idea of the law courts is a fight between the defense and the prosecution, with not anything goes, but a lot goes. We glory in the capitalist system, which we see as entrepreneurs battling to get the buck. We're a very competitive culture, and sports, I don't know whether it's a culture affecting sports or sports affecting
the
culture.
There is that. But look, Frank, I'm gonna give you absolute power, because I can do that on the radio, because I'm God. You're the commissioner of every major league sport. You're the head of the NCAA, and nobody can resist what you say. You can snap your fingers and change one or two or three things. What do you change?
Well, I wouldn't mess around with professional sports so much, but if you say I'm the commissioner of the NCAA, the first thing I would do is say we're going to get rid of all athletic scholarships, we're going to tear down all the arenas and all the stadiums, and we're going to get back to making colleges and universities places where people study and play games only for good exercise and good health. There's no place for big-time athletics in academics. That's our American peculiar institution, and it's very hard to justify it on any basis whatsoever, except, well, it brings in money from rich alumni who give to the schools only because they care about the teams. That's really the only justification.
Well,
we have enough teams. You know, we have enough teams to root for in this country. I think there's well over 100 major league teams and all sorts of minor league teams. We don't need college teams to root for. Now, is that practical to say? Of course not. It's in our DNA in America. We associate athletics with not only with colleges but with high schools. You know, there's examples, all sorts of examples of towns in this country having larger gymnasiums than the population of the school. So it's part of us. But you asked me if I was going to be the ultimate ruler, that's what I would do.
Now, this is a little different than the libertarian solution you outlined in your column a little bit ago. So as a Frank DeFord fan, you're going to have to explain how this is consistent. There you said, let's have football majors, basketball majors, and let the colleges pay whatever they want.
Oh, that was the being practical.
I see.
There's a difference of being practical and being philosophical.
Okay.
I say the system is not going to change. You said if I were king of the world, what would I do? But from a realistic point of view, I say it's in our DNA. It's not going to go away. It's ridiculous to think that we can ever make any adjustments. And while I say, yes, we should get rid of athletic scholarships, and I don't think they can be justified in any way whatsoever, I would go the other way with football and basketball players and say they should get scholarships and be paid and they don't have to go to class because, frankly, they're just entertainers. And why don't we acknowledge that reality?
Roy in San Francisco is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Roy.
Hi. My question is perhaps a little more apropos for tennis than basketball. But when you have an umpire, is there still nevertheless a moral obligation for players to make calls against themselves, even if it overrules the umpire?
So to admit that the guy didn't foul me, or to admit that the shot didn't go out, what do you think, Frank?
Well, you can't expect it very often, and people say that in a team sport you don't have the right to do that, because then you would be ethically letting down. You would be personally superior, but you would be letting down your teammates, and you don't have the obligation. On the other hand, in an individual sport, you can do that. Now, 2 years ago, Andy Roddick, who is our best tennis player, on match point in a match in Italy, the Italian Open, the umpire called the shot that the serve that his opponent hit, called it out, and Roddick said no, the ball was in. Made them replay the point, ultimately lost the match. So there is still...
Just Nana Arden, who sort of didn't make the call against herself against Williams, right?
Yeah, well, yeah. I'm only citing the one example. Most times... Most players feel this way. We can't get into that business.
Yeah, but what...
That the umpires have to do it. I'm not calling the match, and it's all going to even out in the long run. I mean, that's the general philosophy. And by the way, I'm not so sure that it's not the fairest.
Right.
In Roddick's case, this was the last shot of the match, and he simply could not accept it. Had it happened in the middle of the second set at 30-30, then he may very well have just played it the way that it was.
Right, right. Thanks for the call, Roy. But, you know, this raises a question. Suppose that, say, a baseball team, like the American baseball team in the World Baseball Classic, suppose they win a game on a questionable call, and it's manifest to everybody that the referee or the umpire blew the call, and that without the blown call, they probably would not have won, or they might not have won. How should they feel about their victory? Should they feel, well, that's a victory, or what? I mean, it seems diminished in some ways.
I would think it would be terribly diminished, and I think they would have a very, very hard time accepting it. And that's one of the reasons I think that there should always be where we have the opportunity to have instant replay, so that that kind of mistake would not be made, or at least there would be that lesser a chance of such a bad mistake. I can't imagine a team that would win on a bad call feeling satisfied. I think that would would be it.
There are some different situations here. I mean, in some cases, you bring the referee in as part of your strategy, and so shielding the referee or the umpire so they can't really see and will make a bad call is something you might have planned and practiced. Then you'd probably feel pretty good about it, right?
Well, pretty underhanded.
That's a passing thing, and again, that's sort of part of the game. The other team can do that as well. But what was posed is that if you won a game on what was clearly a bad call, could you be satisfied?
Yeah.
Could you be pleased with yourself? I feel that most athletes would not be pleased. That's my sense, that even those who want to win desperately, even those who may not be the most ethically privileged people, that they would feel, in a way, cheated.
Yeah. Yeah, Baleri in San Francisco is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Baleri.
Yes, hello. I would like to make a comment on your point that you compared opera and hip-hop music. And I understand social values and aesthetic values of both form of arts. Nevertheless, I consider that opera takes much longer span attention than hip-hop music. And in comparison to a sport, your guest expressed an opinion that basketball game is most of the most beautiful team played game in the world, and I disagree with it because I think there's other sports, and for example, world soccer or world football, or called soccer, where again the game itself is a very aesthetically pleasing game, but it requires more span. A longer span of attention than it is in a basketball.
Thanks, Baleri. I think there's a point to this, Frank, because one of the things that I like basketball and I love the athleticism of it, but I don't really love the game the way I say love baseball. I love baseball. I think it's a beautiful thing. And one of the things about baseball is that the basic unit of scoring is so easy. Right, in soccer, it's really hard. And if you soccer aficionados love all that defense that makes it so hard to score. And basketball, you know, just score, 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 score. And that seems to me, in some ways, the takeaway from the beauty of it. What do you think?
Well, I said there were other games. I cited the double play, for example, as perhaps the most pretty, most beautiful thing I've seen in sport. It totally baffles me how so many people in this world can profess, as the caller just did, and genuinely, and I accept his feelings, that soccer is a beautiful game. How you can say a game that you play with your feet, when you try to control a ball with your feet and do not use your hands, the very things that God gave us to separate us from the beast of the field, how you can say that that is a prettier game than any other sport played with the hands is absolutely beyond me.
You know, I actually agree. I've made this point to people. It's like, okay, take off the hands and then have people who aren't very fast and who aren't very good with their feet compared to other animals go, you know, the human sort of trick is to be able to use your hands, you know, that opposable thumb thing.
Well, I have to.
Look, I'm amazed. I'm amazed at what soccer players do with their feet. Notwithstanding, I mean, it's like Samuel Johnson said, you know, to watch a dog on his hind legs is amazing that he can do it at all. Never mind that it's done well. A high school baseball or basketball player is more proficient than the greatest soccer player in the world. It's the reality. And yet the rest of the world calls us, you know, dumb and stupid and unaware for not appreciating that soccer is a pretty game. It isn't a pretty game. Can't be a pretty game by definition. And I'm sorry, and that's why
you're going to get us lots of hate mail. Yeah. Just as we're getting to the bottom of the show, you're going to get us lots of hate mail. Frank didn't say it.
I hate to disagree.
I said it. I take responsibility.
I hate to disagree with both.
By the way, I love the World Cup.
Frank DeFord, but I think soccer is quite a beautiful game. I used to coach kids soccer, and that's when I learned the game, and I think it's quite beautiful. I mean, in basketball, you have to dribble. That's completely artificial. Why can't they just carry the ball? Well, I mean, that's just the rules, and that's part of what makes it a beautiful game.
Well, Frank, on that note, I'm going to thank you for joining us. It's been a great conversation. It's been a pleasure having you with us.
Well, I've enjoyed it very much. You've been very welcome.
Our guest has been Frank DeFord, senior writer at Sports Illustrated, commentator on NPR's Morning Edition, author of lots of things. His latest book is The Old Ball Game.
We also want to thank all the callers we didn't get a chance to talk to, and we got some very interesting emails that we just didn't get a chance to read. Sorry about that.
Yeah, I was skeptical that this show was going to work. I have to tell you that, John. Philosophy, basketball, but we had a whole lineup of callers and emails. So, What did you learn today? I mean, well, this was your idea, so
yeah,
you should feel gratified.
I think, you know, you can have fun with philosophy in any subject, and I don't want to demean basketball and say that it's a particularly obscure one. It's a very complicated, interesting game, and a lot of things we didn't get into right at the end. We're getting into the whole idea of how the rules of basketball, which are as artificial as any, create a structure in which the beauty of the game is played. But someday maybe we'll have a show on knitting or crochet or
well,
you know, cutting your dog's paws.
Well, actually, you know, you think about the rules of any of these games and how they contribute to the playing of the game and how they contribute to the aesthetics. It's actually really interesting. Baseball used to be able to do all sorts of things. And they made the infield fly rule because people were taking advantage. They were mm-hmm. dropping the ball and making double plays. And it makes the game more beautiful. So I think the rules of a sport. But I do soccer. It's too hard to score. Baseball, it's too easy to score, and that's why baseball is more beautiful than both.
Well, I think baseball is beautiful, but I'm surprised that coming, as you do, from an American League city, you would have this intelligent opinion, because you guys gave up on the rules with the designated hitter thing. I mean, and you don't really play baseball anymore, in my humble opinion.
Yeah, I certainly don't play it anymore. I do go to, no, the thing about the designated hitter in baseball, just really quickly, there's more of the pure battle between the pitcher and the hitter, right? Because you put up the clueless pitcher, takes away the bat out of the eighth guy, and the pitcher only has to bat to seven real hitters. That's why I love the DH. But that's an issue for another show.
Well, it could be a show. The designated hitter rule, is it the low point of American culture? We'll have to jot that down on our list of shows to do in the future.
But our topic today was basketball, and we'll continue talking about basketball on our blog, Philosophy Talk, the blog, where our motto is Cogito Ergo Blago, I think, therefore, our blog. I blog www.theblog.philosophytalk.org.
And you can download podcasts of our program from our website as well.
Thank you.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
Special thanks to Rujin Shin, Neil Van Leeuwen, Nicole Sawaya, Ben Timpson, and Alan Farley, and to our senior consulting producer, Gordon Earle.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from the Pacific Division of the American Philosophical Association.
And from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk and the members of KALW, local public radio San Francisco, where our program originated.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
The conversation continues on our website, www.philosophytalk.com.
I'm John Perry. And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.